Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. This week, we're going to look at Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro's prospects in July's presidential elections, and his saber-rattling over Venezuela's claim to about two-thirds of neighboring Guyana.
It appears the regime wants to close the road to democracy and peace. What the regime is doing is not a show of strength, it's a show of great weakness.
Back in October last year, Maduro's government and the opposition agreed in Barbados to a set of conditions for elections. The US, in response, lifted some of its sanctions on Venezuelan oil and gas sales, amongst other things. Since then, Maduro has pushed through repressive laws, seemingly in violation of the Barbados deal. The authorities have arrested opposition activists, blocked others from registering as candidates. We just heard opposition politician Maria Corina Machado responding. Just last week, the US let its sanctions carve-out slide, in effect partially reimposing those restrictions. Here's Maduro reacting.
By wanting to harm us, you harm yourselves. We're going ahead, with or without a license. We aren't a Yankee colony. We aren't your colony. Venezuela will move on with its economic pace. No one will stop us, Mr. Yankee. Know that.
The Venezuelan president has also ramped up tensions with neighboring Guyana related to a dispute over the oil-rich Essequibo region.
An area that covers almost 160,000 square kilometers in South America. It is known as the Essequibo, which since 2015 has been found to be rich in natural resources. It is controlled by Guyana, but claimed by Venezuela. On Tuesday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said he will authorize oil exploration in an area close to the Essequibo River and create a new state known as Guyana Essequiba.
That was a clip from last December. That same month, the government organized a referendum on its claim to Essequibo. Top Maduro allies accused opponents of sabotaging the vote, raising fears that the government, in escalating the crisis, had one eye on the presidential election. This week, though, has brought some good news, with the opposition uniting behind a candidate, Edmundo González, and the government accepting his papers. So what are prospects for a reasonably free election? Could that offer a way out of Venezuela's long-running political crisis? And what to make of Venezuela's claim to Essequibo? To talk about all this, I'm very happy to welcome back onto the show Phil Gunson, Crisis Group's Venezuela expert. Phil, welcome back on.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's a crucial moment in Venezuela, so I think you've chosen the right time to do it.
Good. So let's start then with what's happening now. As we just heard, there seems to be, an opposition candidate, Edmundo González, who's been able to register with the authorities, and that the various opposition factions, politicians, have thrown their weight behind. Not something that's always been the case in Venezuela before.
Yeah, well, you're right. It's all happened in the last week. And just yesterday, we were all biting our nails. We were really on the brink of what some people call the Nicaraguan route. In other words, the government really deciding to pull the plug on this and go for essentially stealing the election. But that hasn't happened. So what we do have is, again, at the very last minute, the opposition, the main opposition alliance, which is known as the Unitary Platform, which is an alliance of 10 parties, and they don't always see eye to eye among themselves. They came together around the candidacy of this gentleman called Edmundo González Urrutia. Now, he had originally been registered only as a stand-in. He wasn't expecting to have to stand for the presidency. And when it came down to it, he was the only one that they could agree on. So it's Edmundo González, and the government yesterday allowed the other parties that had already registered different candidates but wanted to support his candidacy to do that. They had been blocking it, but they let that through. So he now apparently has the support of all the parties in the main coalition, and we're set to go pretty much.
Phil, do you want to say a word or two about Edmundo González? Who is he? What's his background?
Yes, Edmundo, who happens to be a neighbour of mine, he lives quite close by. Edmundo is a retired diplomat. He's not been someone who has been in the front line politically at all. He's been associated for well over a decade, about 15 years, I think, with the opposition in the form of an advisor on international relations. And he is politically moderate. He is kind of soft-spoken. Under normal circumstances, he wouldn't be a great candidate because he's not the sort of man who stands up on the hustings and makes rousing speeches. But in these circumstances, I think he may be ideal in the sense that not only because it's been easier to agree on him within the opposition, but he's the sort of person that in the scenario that the government really doesn't want to contemplate, which is that he wins, he's the sort of person that I think they could do business with. He's the sort of person who would unite the country rather than dividing it and would not be a figure associated with revenge and sending all the leaders of the Ancien Régime to jail.
So there's President Maduro, the incumbent. There's Edmundo González, the main opposition contender. Are there other candidates?
Altogether, there are now 12 candidates registered, including, of course, President Nicolás Maduro, who's standing for re-election. Most of the other 10, apart from Maduro and González, belong to small parties, some of which are actually dominated by the government, even though they claim to be opposition. And their main function from the point of view of the government is that they divide the opposition vote and they confuse voters. So they, in theory, they should take away votes from the opposition. The real race is between the candidate of the Unity Platform and Maduro standing for re-election.
And Phil, it's a single round system, right, with no runoff. So whoever wins the most votes in that round wins the presidency, meaning if the opposition splits its vote, that plays to the advantage of Maduro.
That's a very important point, actually, Richard. Of course, in a lot of countries in Latin America, perhaps the majority, presidential elections have a second round. So in order to win on the first round, you need to get more than 50% of the vote. That's not the case in Venezuela. So in the past, and this has always been the case that it's just a single round, in the past, for example, back in the early 90s, the presidency was won with just over 30% of the vote. So Maduro doesn't have to have a majority support. He just has to make sure that all the anti-Maduro votes are dispersed among this raft of small candidates. And the real threat to him is precisely the kind of opposition unity that we've seen demonstrated in the last, say, 48 hours.
So let's back up then and sort of talk a little bit about how we got here. And could we go back to the Barbados deal? So that was last October, a deal between the Maduro government and the opposition. Do you want to tell us a bit about what was at the core of that agreement?
Yes, the government and the opposition have had many, many rounds of negotiations. I mean, all the way back to 20 years ago, on and off, there have been negotiations. And the most recent set started out in 2019 when Trump was in power. Venezuela was under the maximum pressure policy, which basically amounted to regime change. Heavy US sanctions were imposed and so on.
And Phil, maybe just to refresh people of the maximum pressure approach. So that was the Trump administration imposing these harsh sanctions. As you say, there was this failed coup attempt, I think, though details of that are a bit murky. But there was also the US and other governments recognizing opposition politician Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. So ratcheting up pressure in various forms on Maduro. But by the last year of Trump's presidency, that policy seemed to have largely run its course. It was clear that it wasn't going to topple the government, and even towards the end of Trump's presidency, his administration had sort of shifted tack toward Venezuela.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the hardline policy, maximum pressure, the whole interim government idea, that the sort of parallel administration under Juan Guaido, that actually became recognized by well over 50 countries worldwide, including most of the European Union and many of Venezuela's regional neighbors. But yes, that failed. And that brought about a return to a kind of more moderate line, both internationally and nationally. So these negotiations that began in 2019 have been facilitated by Norway, which, of course, has a lot of experience in this field. And most of them take place here in Caracas. They take place often directly between government and opposition negotiators, but it's a very laborious process. And then if they do reach an agreement, then the Norwegians set up a meeting. Originally, it was in Mexico. The latest one was in Barbados, where the two sides actually sign an agreement. And the latest one, it was on the 17th of October. And it was primarily to do with electoral conditions, with the government agreeing essentially to a set of minimal electoral conditions. The real negotiations, if you like, the negotiations that allowed this to go ahead were direct negotiations between Caracas and Washington, between the Maduro government and the Biden administration, which started out actually in Doha, in Qatar.
And these were separate talks between the US and the Maduro government, as you say, and maybe worth noting that the US had broken off diplomatic relations in, what, I think 2019, as part of maximum pressure with the Venezuelan government. But these were talks between the US and Venezuela, mediated, as you say, by the Qataris, and separate to the track between the government and the opposition.
They were separate but linked in the sense that the US says to Maduro, well, look, you know, you Venezuelans have to agree, you know, on a set of conditions for the elections. If you do that, if you come to an agreement with the platform, which is the people that we recognize as representing most of the opposition, then we will give you relief from this broad set of economic sanctions that were introduced by Trump. And indeed, they did that. I mean, just after the Barbados Agreement was signed, the US gave, most importantly, a very broad license under the sanctions regime, which allowed Venezuela to start selling its oil and gas again to the United States and on the international market. And that was a big boost to Maduro and to the economy. This was the quid pro quo. You agree to hold a fair election and we will gradually lift sanctions.
And the US, motivated in large part by wanting to resolve a crisis that's long been an open wound in Latin America, fuels an enormous amount of migration. But tell me if this is right, Phil. In some ways, the opportunity for this deal between the Biden administration and the Maduro government also came through the US after the Ukraine war, wanting to buy Venezuelan oil and gas, get Venezuelan oil and gas onto global markets and establishing contacts with Caracas with that aim in mind.
Yeah, it would be a win-win situation, really. Migration, obviously, is a really crucial issue, and especially in an election year in the United States. And for most of the last year, at least, you know, the migrants turning up at the U.S. southern border and attempting to cross without permission, there's a huge number of Venezuelans. They're traveling there in the most dreadful conditions and having to cross on foot the Darien Gap between Colombia and Panama, which has been up until very recently impenetrable jungle. So they're fleeing, obviously, a desperate humanitarian crisis here. And the US figures, I think, quite rationally that if you can solve the political situation, which is at the root of this humanitarian crisis, then you can reduce that migration pressure. That's a big thing. The energy thing that you mentioned, I mean, Venezuela's oil industry is in dire straits, so it can't really put an awful lot of additional oil onto the world market in short order, but certainly it would be good for that oil to start flowing again, for the oil industry to recover. And there's another issue as well, which is geopolitical, which is that Venezuela, in part due to the pressure of sanctions, has been forced more into the arms of the US's geostrategic adversaries like Russia, like Iran, like China. And yet, additionally, of course, the issue in itself of Venezuelan lack of democracy, which is a destabilizing factor in the region, is not a minor issue for the United States in seeking this agreement.
And for the Maduro government, their calculations in agreeing, you know, we can talk about how much they've stuck to what they agreed, but their calculation back then with the Barbados Agreement was largely driven by wanting sanctions relief, wanting to ease some of the pressure on the Venezuelan economy.
Yes. I mean, obviously, you know, the people at the top of the tree in the government are doing fine. I mean, most of them, of course, are personally sanctioned, but they're safe here while they're in power. But the economy is really in dire shape. Under Maduro, the economy lost about 80% of GDP. Now, in an election year, Maduro needs the cash, you know, to put it crudely, to buy votes. But if you want to be more diplomatic about it, to present the, you know, an image of recovery and to ensure that he's re-elected because people genuinely think that things are going to get better under him. But the other issue is also recognition. I mean, when we talk to people on the Chavista side, on the government sympathizers, they're clear that you know, this issue of non-recognition, this issue of not being regarded as a legitimate government, aside from the sheer inconvenience in terms of international relations, it also rankles. Maduro wants to be recognized. And in that regard, the issue of a fair election is not just about sanctions relief. It's also about kind of proving to his own supporters and to the international community that he is the legitimate president of Venezuela.
And so the Barbados Agreement, mid-October, that leads very quickly to this opposition primary. And in that primary, Maria Corina Machado, who we heard up top, she basically cleaned up, winning the vast majority of the votes. She's traditionally known, I mean, tell me if this is wrong, Phil, as quite uncompromising. How did she muster so much support?
Yeah, Maria Corina Machado has been around for a long time. She's been in politics now for a couple of decades. She's very outspoken, very brave. She's a great campaigner. But she hasn't had a lot of support, and she's been divorced from the parties. I mean, she has her own party, but it's not actually officially registered. It's always been kind of small. I think what happened is a couple of things. One, the interim government under Juan Guaido, which was a creature of the United Opposition, even though many people in the opposition quietly thought it was a rather bad idea.
And maybe just to clarify, I mean, the interim government, as it was called, which you talked about earlier, was recognised by many countries as the legitimate Venezuelan government under Juan Guaido, but it never actually had any governance role in Venezuela. And over time, it sort of failed to really get off the ground.
Yes, that's right. That interim government collapsed. That whole experiment, the maximum pressure and so on, fell apart amid, you know, accusations that there was corruption, that they had used Venezuela's offshore assets, which were frozen by the United States, to enrich themselves. And so the pendulum swung back to a more moderate approach, the electoral route, negotiations and so on. But of course, all the moderates, they'd also been associated with the interim government. They hadn't broken with it really until the very last minute. And so they're really all tarred with the same brush. And Maria Corina, who had not been a part of this and who had been very critical of the interim government, despite having supported it as an idea from the beginning, she was kind of the only well-known politician still with her reputation intact. She wasn't a part of the interim government. She hadn't been tainted by it. And because she's a person who's very, she's a great campaigner, and she has a very good image, and a personal image, regardless of what people think about her policies. I mean, she's quite to the right of center. She's conservative in economic and social terms. But she was the one that people saw when it came to the primary. She was the one that people saw could maybe deliver. So she was the last one standing in a way.
So there's the Barbados Agreement, there's the primary, Maria Corina wins. And since then, what, the government has passed laws, cracked down in a way that violates at least the spirit, if not the actual word of the agreement?
Yes. First of all, I think we have to bear in mind, and I don't think we've mentioned it so far, that Maria Corina was banned from standing for any elected office some time back. That ban expired. The government had never clarified whether she was still banned. In the Barbados Agreement, there was a clause that said the government would set up a mechanism whereby these bans, it's not just her, there are well over 1,000 politicians, most of them unknowns, but some front-rank politicians, but a mechanism that would review these bans, obviously with the idea that in order for there to be a fair election, the ban on Maria Corina had to be lifted. Well, the government never really intended to lift the ban on Maria Corina. They did establish a kind of a mechanism for review, which was only really, I mean, it was a mechanism on paper. It was really the government deciding whether they would lift the ban or not. And they reaffirmed it. But at the same time, we've seen a crackdown on civil society. We've seen the government pushing through Parliament once again a law that would pretty much ban any independent NGOs, a law which is called the anti-fascist law, which potentially could outlaw dissent, because anything the government doesn't like becomes defined as fascist speech. And something that no doubt we'll talk about separately is a law for what they call the defense of the Essequibo territory, which is their claim on a large chunk of a neighboring country, Guyana. And this law as well includes clauses that ban you from participating in politics if you don't, let's say, take the Guyanese side and you don't support Venezuela's claim. So all these things have been going on. They've arrested many of Maria Corina's principal activists in the regions. They've arrested two of her key close collaborators here in Caracas. Six others have had to take refuge in the Argentine embassy because they had arrest warrants out for them. Generally speaking, the whole political and social environment has become distinctly chillier since the signing of the Barbados Agreement, which is precisely the reverse of what was supposed to happen.
And in response, the US threatened to stop the sanctions relief. And in fact, just a few days ago, on the 17th of April, it reimposed some of the sanctions, right?
Yes, the very explicit threat was that if the government reneged on its commitments under Barbados, then this sanctions relief would expire. The main license, the principal one that I talked about, oil and gas sales, that expired a week ago or so ago, and the US did not renew it. However, they did leave a window open, which is that they have said explicitly that there can be individual licenses for particular companies to do business with the state oil company. So there's an opportunity there, which also means letting the Maduro government know that if it continues to crack down, if it continues to close off the space for any kind of competitive election, then there are more consequences coming down the line.
And Phil, how much had the sanctions relief, how much had that actually helped the Venezuelan economy?
Well, it had helped, not as much as it would have if it hadn't been cut off right now. Obviously, the anticipation, economists were suggesting that the GDP would grow perhaps by as much as 9 or 10% this year if that license remained in place for the whole year. There will be growth, but it'll be a lot smaller than that. I mean, perhaps 3, 4%. It helps, but it doesn't allow Maduro by any means to splurge on, for example, boosting minimum wages, which are among the lowest in the world. I mean, a minimum wage here, official minimum wage, is not much more than about $3 at the moment, $3, $4.
$3 or $4 a day?
A month.
$3 or $4 a month?
A month is the minimum wage, yes. Now, nobody earns that, of course, because you would die if you tried to live on $3 or $4 a month. There are supplements which don't form part of the wage, which the government has been increasing. But even so, I mean, it's very, very difficult for ordinary Venezuelans who don't have access to, let's say, a dollar income or who are not working in the private sector. And particularly public sector employees are in really bad shape because the government has no money to pay them.
And the collapsed economy has fueled this dreadful humanitarian crisis, right? And the health sector collapsing, this exodus, many Venezuelans leaving, some going north, as you say, to the US, but millions in Colombia and others of Venezuela's neighbours. Can you tell us a bit about that crisis?
It's absolutely dire. And this is a humanitarian situation that is, you know, it's not unique in the world, obviously. But one of the things that is unique about the Venezuela situation is the international response has been very, very much less. You know, you're talking about, in per capita terms, probably only about a fifth of what is contributed for crises elsewhere in the world. And what we have here is a total systemic breakdown. I mean, this isn't like you have an earthquake, say, in part of the country. You have a specific crisis, emergency situation that over time can be resolved. This is the collapse of a nation of 30 million people. Every significant part of the infrastructure, whether it's roads, electricity, water, you mentioned the health service, everything has broken down, and including the mainstay of the economy, the oil industry. And so people who are earning these extraordinarily low salaries don't even have the benefit of, you know, a good government-run safety net. If you go to a public hospital, there are no medicine. You know, you have to take your own sheets. You have to buy your own blood if you need a transfusion. If you need a scan or any kind of procedure, all of this is having to be paid for in dollars because most of the time public hospitals don't even have the equipment. The electricity, we have regular blackouts, not so much in Caracas as in the rest of the country, but elsewhere in the country, there are blackouts lasting hours every day. People sometimes go weeks or even months without running water. And of course, all this has a massive impact on health, and particularly and most tragically, perhaps among children. I mean, infant malnutrition has grown hugely. Cancer patients, anybody with a chronic illness, of course, if they don't have private resources there, they can't rely on the state-run system to fix it.
And much of this owes to the government's own economic mismanagement. Mismanagement is probably an understatement, but presumably the sanctions haven't helped either.
Well, right. I mean, what are the sanctions aimed at? I mean, the sanctions are aimed at, you know, forcing Maduro to the negotiating table by damaging the economy. It's inevitable that that has an impact on people. In some cases, you know, you can point to things that are perhaps even more direct. I mean, there was a period when the US was deliberately trying to minimize the gasoline supply. Well, I mean, if you don't have any petrol to put in the tank, if your mother has a heart attack, you can't take her to the hospital because there's no transport. Ambulances don't have petrol. Everything that you rely on for daily life, a lot of the power stations run on diesel. So, you know, and the fact that the oil industry and the associated refineries are in extremely bad shape, of course, is the fault of the government. But on top of that, you had the US deliberately trying to make things worse. I mean, some of that is slightly better now. But obviously, if your aim is to squeeze the economy, then you're squeezing the people.
So we'll come in a moment to talk about the US, but some of the other outside governments and particularly those in the region, Brazil, Colombia in particular. But Phil, you mentioned Essequibo, a big chunk of Guyana that Venezuela has claims to. How much should we see the government's rhetoric about Essequibo? How much should we see that as election related?
In part, it is election related. You know, this is a long-standing claim that was revived in the middle of the last century, that Guyana and Venezuela on and off held talks about under the good offices of the United Nations. That claim, which, as you say, is to a large part of Guyana, it's about two-thirds of Guyanese territory. It's a massive chunk. It's about the size of Florida, so that, you know, people get an idea of what size of territory we're talking about. That claim to the Essequibo on the part of Venezuela is now in the hands of the International Court of Justice. Venezuela doesn't accept that. They don't accept the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. And a couple of other things have happened as well, but most particularly, Guyana struck oil with the help of particularly ExxonMobil offshore, a large part of it in waters that correspond to the Essequibo territory, in other words, the projection offshore of that territory. And of course, Venezuela, especially since its own oil industry has been run into the ground and it's increasingly poor. It's very galling for Venezuela to see its formerly poor neighbor strike such large quantities of oil. But to the electoral point, you know, it's useful, obviously, for a politician in trouble. It's useful to wrap yourself in the flag, to find a nationalist issue that everybody can agree on. And I think apart from that, Maduro's obviously also giving himself a let out here, whereby if he chooses to ratchet up the tension with Guyana at any point, he can fabricate himself an excuse to declare a state of emergency, maybe suspend or cancel the elections. That's also a possibility. And it also makes a useful stick with which to beat the opposition. Because although the opposition doesn't disagree on the Essequibo claim, it does disagree with the way the government has approached it. So the government can say rather unfairly, that the opposition are treasonous in their approach to the Essequibo issue.
And Phil, what's the basis of the claim?
The basis of the claim is that all the land up to the Essequibo River, which runs right beside Georgetown, the capital of Guyana, was a part of the Capitanía General de Venezuela under the Spanish Empire. And I think there are some solid arguments behind this. When the British bought Guyanese territories off the Dutch, one of which was the Essequibo, that boundary had not been settled. And the British, through sleight of hand and great power politics, were able to impose their rule over the Essequibo. Venezuela didn't have a presence there. And, you know, Venezuela believes they were cheated out of it by a deal among the great powers in 1899. And they revived that in the middle of the last century on the basis of some new documents that came to light.
And Phil, I mean, presumably Venezuelan troops marching into Guyana, I mean, that seems pretty far-fetched.
It's quite hard to march into the Essequibo because it's all jungle and there isn't a road. So it would be infiltration rather than you couldn't imagine a kind of a tank battalion, rolling across the border. Where I think there could be issues if Venezuela decides to do more than just saber rattle is offshore, because offshore, first of all, legally, it's a different issue. Those waters have not been demarcated. There is an argument that, you know, Guyana is extracting oil from waters that might potentially belong to Venezuela. But also from a military point of view, it's a lot easier to cause trouble offshore in this case than it is on land. And Venezuela has some fast missile boats that it's bought from Iran that are stationed quite close to that border. And I think that the Guyanese, who have a small, weak defense force, are eyeing those very nervously. And of course, if that were to happen, then the impact on the oil companies would be significant because, you know, oil platforms are not generally defended by the military. These are civilian operations that are very vulnerable to attack. And I know, although I think it's far-fetched to imagine that Maduro is going to fire missiles at an ExxonMobil platform, you know, the threat to do it can also cause trouble.
So let's move then to Venezuela's neighbours, particularly Brazil. So Brazilian President Ignacio Lula da Silva, so President Lula, traditionally has had pretty good relations comparatively with first the Chavez government, now the Maduro government. Played quite an important role, from what I understand, in calming some of the tensions late last year around Essequibo. How has Lula, the Brazilian government, how have they been involved in the follow-ups, the Barbados agreements, the internal Venezuelan political process?
Yes, in terms of the regional response, that's to say Latin America and the Caribbean, I mean, Brazil clearly aspires to be a leader. And of course, as you say, there's a certain ideological affinity. I mean, these are both governments of the left, although, you know, Maduro is an authoritarian leftist, whereas Lula is a Democrat. Brazil has to be worried, and Lula, you know, clearly is worried over the Essequibo, because this is a strategic issue for them. The road that they're helping the Guyanese build through Guyana to the Guyanese coast from the Brazilian border is a strategic issue for them in terms of their access to the North Atlantic. And obviously, they don't want to see any kind of military conflict in particular near their northern border. They've made that very clear to Maduro. And when Maduro started seriously saber-rattling towards the end of last year, the Brazilian government moved very fast to get together a regional coalition to head that off and to get Maduro and the Guyanese president, Irfan Ali, to sign a kind of non-aggression pact. But then there's the issue of the elections. Lula, along with most other governments in the region, is very reluctant to do what they see as interfering in Venezuela's internal affairs. But lately, the signs out of Brasilia, the kind of statements that they've been making, the Brazilian foreign ministry and Lula himself, have indicated considerable concern. And although they don't want to intervene, they themselves, you know, admit that behind the scenes, in private, they are talking to Maduro, trying to urge him to hold a democratic election. Because the options, if he doesn't, are not great for Brazil. They don't believe in sanctions. They don't believe in breaking off relations. And from Lula's own point of view, I mean, he himself, as president of Brazil, as a politician, as a person, he's become increasingly irritated with the behavior of the Maduro government, especially since the Essequibo incidents of last year. And the statements have been criticizing Maduro's behavior as undemocratic. And the Maduro government has not responded well. I mean, they've responded with insults. They've responded, at least in public, by talking about Lula and Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, also a government of the left. Maduro has referred to them as the cowardly left. I mean, these are terms that don't obviously go down very well either in terms of the politics of the countries concerned or the personal feelings of the president's concern.
And Phil, Colombian President Gustavo Petro, you mentioned, I mean, he's in a bit of a spot because not only has he tried to repair relations with Caracas since coming to power, those relations were fraught under his predecessor, Iván Duque, but in some ways, Petro needs Maduro for his Paz Total plan, which, you know, basically entails peace talks with Colombia's armed groups, including its last rebel holdout, the ELN. And the ELN is what, based in Venezuela, or at least close to the Venezuelan government?
Yes. When Gustavo Petro came to office a little less than 2 years ago, He immediately moved to restore relations with Venezuela, which had been cut off under the previous government. And his approach has been entirely one of wooing Maduro back to a more democratic line, trying to get him back into, for example, the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights and the OAS and so on. But as you say, Petro, to some extent, has his hands tied because he's tremendously dependent on Venezuela. These are two countries that share a common border of well over 2,000 kilometers, which is not only porous, but plagued with armed groups of various kinds, including Colombian guerrillas and breakaway groups and the Colombian guerrillas and criminal cartels and so on. Petro is trying to make peace with all the various armed groups in Colombia, but almost all of them have some kind of presence over here in Venezuela. So without the collaboration of the Venezuelan government, which has historically had very close links to the Colombian guerrillas, then it's very hard for him to do that. In fact, the peace talks with the ELN, which are not going very well, are hosted in part by Venezuela. In the last few days, they've held sessions here. And it's the Venezuelans that really deal in relations with the ELN and kind of, if you like, bring the ELN to the table. It's hard, therefore, for Petro to really adopt a hard line with Maduro over the issue of democracy and human rights because of his dependence on the Venezuelan government.
So, Phil, as July approaches, as election day approaches, presumably as campaigning starts in force, the Maduro government faces this balancing act, right? As you say, it wants an election that doesn't look too awful, that looks reasonably credible, ideally allows it to keep some sanctions relief. As you say, it's also important for its international, its foreign legitimacy. At the same time, it obviously doesn't want to lose power, and it's not popular. President Maduro, far less popular, arguably, than his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. Whatever people thought of Chavez, he had a much more solid base of support than Maduro does today. You know, that sort of balance, an increasingly unpopular government wanting to hold on to power, usually ends up with a government that's increasingly harsh and repressive, as you called it earlier, the Nicaragua route, the direction President Daniel Ortega has taken there. But sometimes it can end up with a miscalculation as well. Do you think there's any chance of that happening in Venezuela, that somehow Maduro gets the balance wrong, ends up losing or in some sort of contested vote that opens up space for talks or some other way out of Venezuela's sort of long political crisis?
Yes, they're as aware as everybody, as aware as we are of the danger of miscalculation. They've seen what's happened elsewhere in the region and elsewhere in the world. One case that's frequently cited here is that of Pinochet. When Pinochet held a referendum, he was sure he was going to win and the No campaign beat him. And that ended up leading to a transition in Chile, which to a degree is still going on today. These transitions tend to take a very long time if they're going to work. And that has to be the hope for Venezuela because, you know, there's still some in the opposition who I think see transition in terms of an event, whereas the transition is a process. And it needs to begin with the recognition by both sides, actually, that there can be no simple handover of power as would happen in a normal democracy. It's far too complicated. For example, let's say Edmundo González wins the election on July 28th and Maduro decides to hand over power. The opposition would only control the presidency. They wouldn't control parliament. They wouldn't control the Supreme Court. They wouldn't control, you know, any of the key institutions. The military has been dominated by the Chavistas. The oil industry, presumably there's some things that a president could come in, you know, could change the leadership in some areas. But a lot of the institutional structure and the institutional inertia of Venezuela is fundamentally anti-opposition. And so I think the best case scenario here is that this election triggers a process which leads to serious negotiations towards a transition, not the kind of negotiations that we've seen so far, where on the one hand, they've been very specifically focused on particular issues like election conditions in this case. But also, you know, negotiations that where both sides have looked at them as a way of defeating the other. In other words, it's a zero sum game until the two come together and realize that without each other, there can be no, you know, fruitful path forward, then we're stuck. So how can that happen? It could happen with an opposition victory because between July and the inauguration of the next government, which is in January, there are 5 months, which is quite a long time to negotiate some kind of transition. It could happen if Maduro decides to reject the result or cheat in such a way that it's obvious to everybody. That could cause a crisis within the government itself, within among its supporters, and particularly in the military. But, you know, whatever way it happens, the key thing is this trigger point where everybody suddenly decides that there has to be a full-scale negotiation. And that negotiation has to include, for example, issues of transitional justice, has to include guarantees for the outgoing leadership, perhaps some form of, as in the case of Chile, for example, you know, that Pinochet was given a lifelong Senate seat, you know, that gives him immunity from prosecution. You know, the outgoing regimes these days are not very convinced by these kinds of guarantees because they've all seen how they tend to break down with time. So it's not easy, but that is the kind of path forward that we envisage if things were to go well. But we're in a very delicate situation. Things are poised really on a knife edge. If it goes badly, we are headed for something much more similar to, you know, the Nicaraguan dictatorship.
It does seem, as you say, Phil, that sort of a peaceful transition, a way out of this long-running crisis, as we talked about, the odds do seem sort of stacked against that happening. And it's also true that the Venezuelan opposition, Latin American governments, Western powers have tried many different things over the years, particularly since Nicolas Maduro came to power and has become increasingly unpopular. Contesting elections, they've boycotted them. Outside powers have recognised an alternative government. They've tried pressure, they've tried diplomacy. And often the region and the West have worked quite effectively together. So in some ways, it's not for want of trying. It's very hard, as we've seen in many other places, to find a way out of a crisis that's kind of rooted in an unpopular government determined to hold on to power, seeing such high stakes in its own survival. But Phil, can I ask, people have traditionally seemed to assume that the way out of this crisis is through elections, in large part because the government hasn't been ready to sort of enter into any other sort of talks. But do you think that's right, that elections are the best path out of the crisis, as opposed to, for example, talks over power sharing or something along those lines?
What I have in mind, I would prefer to describe as cohabitation. In other words, it's a situation where the government continues to control the executive and is the government, but the opposition perhaps controls the legislature or has a major say in the legislature, and that is used as the basis for negotiation. It's what should have happened back in 2016, because in December 2015, the opposition won a supermajority in the National Assembly, in the Venezuelan parliament, and both sides blew it, particularly the government. The government essentially refused to accept the opposition's control of parliament, and that's what led to the disaster that happened thereafter. What should have happened, of course, is that the government and the opposition got into serious talks. And at that point, had wiser heads prevailed, then we could have begun a transition. And it didn't happen. It went wrong. So in a sense, this election, this presidential election, plus what's coming down the road, because next year we have scheduled at least legislative and probably regional elections as well. You know, this could be a scenario in which a gradual opening starts to happen, but only if, you know, the two sides, both of them simultaneously, because there's no good one of them deciding and the other one not. They have to both determine that they have to work together towards this.
And I assume it's hard to tell what might trigger a split within Chavismo, within the government. I mean, people sort of hope the military might split off during the maximum pressure campaign, and in the end that didn't happen.
You know, it's very hard to know. It's right what you say, that maximum pressure, far from splitting the military, seemed to make them more cohesive. And in general, the military and the civilian Chavista establishment hung together because otherwise they were going to hang separately. And I've always felt that opening up was the way to foment those kinds of disagreements, because the more it can be seen that there is an alternative to hardline policies and that it doesn't lead direct to a jail cell, for example, then the more it's possible for those people on the government side who would prefer to see normalization and prefer to see a return to prosperity and to normal international relations and so on, for those people to poke their heads above the parapet much easier when, you know, they're not facing down the barrel of a gun.
Phil, thanks so much for coming on again.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. Richard Atwood. For all of our Venezuela work, you can check out a piece that Phil wrote on the forthcoming elections last week. Do look at our website, crisisgroup.org. Thanks to our producers, Kevin Murphy, Heiko Schaub, and thanks, as ever, to all our listeners. As usual, please do get in touch. podcast@crisisgroup.org or atwood@crisisgroup.org if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns. If you like the show, say something nice about us. Wherever you get your podcasts, leave us a good review. It helps people find us. And I very much hope that you'll join us again next time.